From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar. Today we take a look at the headlines at consortiumnews.com with Editor-in-Chief Joe Lauria. Well, Joe, let's see. We're starting looking at the front page again, and I was kind of surprised. I saw all this stuff about with different pieces by Bob Perry and about Bob Perry, and then I realized it must be that time of year. It's the end of the year when people make their tax-deductible donations to their various causes, and it must be Fund Drive. So good luck with Fund Drive, but I want to go into some of the articles that are not part of that, looking at starting with John Kiriakou's piece about Alexis Tsipras and Syriza, which is something I've wanted to revisit ever since we were reporting on the election that brought Syriza to power a few years back and the whole drama that played, as opposed to the drachma that played out after that.
Yes, John Kiriakou, who is Greek-American, and he may actually have dual citizenship, but I don't know for sure about that. But so John knows Greece extremely well. He knows the language, and he's lived there for many, many years, as well as here in the States.
He was stationed there, right? Yeah.
Sorry?
He was stationed there, actually.
Yeah. He was stationed there for a while. Before I get to that, though, the second half of the article I want to talk about first briefly, because he does do a pretty good critique. He's not the first one, of course, to critique the hypocrisy and the phoniness, basically, of the Syriza party and the prime minister, who, of course, led the Greeks to people to believe that he was ready to leave the eurozone and bring back the drachma if this referendum passed. It did pass, and he was caught by surprise, somewhat like Cameron, who had at least the decency to resign when he put Brexit forward. He didn't think it was any chance it would win, and he wanted to just sort of bury this issue because it was so divisive within the government and his party. So he had the thing, and Brexit won, and he stepped down.
Right.
Whereas this guy, Tsipras, is still the prime minister, and he really betrayed the Greek people and forced Varoufakis, the economics minister who did the negotiating with Europeans, to resign. So he does a pretty good critique about how the guy has been pretty much a hypocrite and a failure.
Yeah.
It's the first part of the article that's extremely interesting. And something that might be in John's book, he wrote a book, I believe. I have not read the book. I presume most of the readers of Consortium News or your listeners have not read it. So he reveals something here, I don't think, again, for the first time, but even if it's not, it's for a lot of people the first time, and that was that he was stationed from 1998 to 2000 as a CIA officer in Athens, because John Kiriakou was a CIA agent, not an analyst back in Langley like Ray McGovern was, actually in the field, carrying gun-carrying, covert CIA agent, the ones of film and book fame, those type, you know. So he was really out there on the ground, and he worked in Athens. And there's this group called 17 November, which since 1990s has killed 23 people through assassination, mostly foreign diplomats, a Greek publisher, a member of parliament, a CIA station chief in Athens, two U.S. defense attachés, a U.S. Air Force sergeant, and his neighbor was a British defense attaché who was killed in August of 2000. And John found out that he was on the list, and he was able to get out of the country and survive. So he was targeted by this 17 November group, and he made it out. And now why he brings this up is because Tsipras, the prime minister now, in John's estimation, because he's been such a failure on the promises he made on the economic issues, on the relationship with the EU and the banks and the Troika and all of that, he's trying to do something to placate his critics on the left. And he decided he wanted to give amnesty to a lot of these 17 November members who have been in prison. And John, because he was the target, he has a personal stake in that. He's not unbiased, says that this is wrong, that these guys were terrorists, and that the United States has given him instructions not to let them out, and he's disobeying America and this and that. So that's why John is taking, and I made it clear he's not unbiased in the second paragraph, or third, it starts that way, I'm not unbiased on this issue, because these guys try to kill me. But I wanted to raise another issue with you, Don, and I raised it with John, but he didn't want to engage me. I did it by email. I don't know whether he saw the email. And when I see him next time, I will see if he wants to talk about it. It's just a technical legal issue, really. Is terrorism, in my estimation, first of all, it's never been defined by the General Assembly of the United Nations, so countries cannot agree on a firm definition of terrorism. One man's terrorist is another man's freedom fighter. But I generally go by, and a lot of people do, that it has to be conducted by a non-state actor, not a government person. Could be sponsored, paid for by a government, but the actors themselves are non-governmental, and they target innocent, random civilians or a high-value target, and not caring that innocent, random civilians will be killed for political reasons.
Right.
That's why I don't believe a state can commit terrorism. I think states commit war crimes and crimes against humanity, which in my view are worse than terrorism, because it usually involves far more numbers of dead when you're bombing a country than one terrorist bombing in a cafe. So that's a whole other discussion we could have another time. People argue that Israel is a terrorist state. I say they sponsor terrorism, the United States does, right. And certainly Saudi Arabia does, and right. Many countries have sponsored terrorism, but the state itself cannot commit terrorism.
So
but
this, anyway, is, this something, is something, because, you know, yeah. this principle and agent issue is something that kind of, you know, befuddles the conversation, you know, when you're trying to define terms. For example, exactly, say Israel was a sponsor of terrorism. So right. You find terrorists who are non-state actors and say right. Mossad or, you know, the government proper in Israel or whatever, or the U.S. government or CIA hires them.
Yes.
But trains them, you know, organizes yes. them, trains them,
arms
pays
them.
But they're not part of the apparatus per se.
Correct.
They're, you know, they're contractors. Well, they're non-state actors, even though they're actually agents of state. And so they're state agents. They're
yes.
not state actors proper. But I look at the government in Ukraine right now. When people talk about where fascism resides in the halls of power, well, okay, yeah. If the U.S. government is not controlled by, isn't fascist, how is it that they install a fascist government in Ukraine? You know, and
well,
or
Trump,
if,
yeah.
So, I mean, it's that you have a principal agent, you know, situation confounding the discussion of terms. And so while we talk about these things, certainly people shouldn't be confused about the fact that when you call something war crime instead of terrorism, that it's somehow worse or better in terms of the set of acts that are conducted, the damage that's done to innocents and to, you know, the public and the world at large in general. They're just, you know, we're sort of using legalisms.
Absolutely.
To try to classify things as one of these
right.
instead of one
it's
of those.
Purely legalistic and academic discussion,
right,
which is,
exactly.
in the end of the day, not all that important because innocent
right.
people die at the hands of a government, whether they do it directly or they don't. But it does get me sometimes when I see people just using this word terrorism or fascism so easily without understanding, in my opinion, what it means. So,
I mean, it almost comes down to was there withholding in their paycheck? If there wasn't withholding, then you know, then it's a contract
exactly.
payment. Okay.
Yeah,
if it is withholding, they're employees.
Except under the New York
right.
state law, maybe they are employees
right.
because they're given instructions,
right.
they're given their equipment.
Right, exactly.
So maybe under labor law, they really are employees of the government, not
right.
independent contractors. Like jihadists in Syria, clearly
right.
backed by Saudi Arabia, by
exactly.
Turkey,
yeah, exactly.
Paid for by the Saudis, direct to right. train by the U.S. armed. But they don't. You know, they're not the U.S. government. They're not the Saudi government. They
right.
gives them plausible deniability. Let's
right.
face it. That's
right.
one of the reasons to use these guns.
Right.
And by the way, these jihadists have their own. They already have the same aim. So there is a confluence of objectives that come together in
right.
short term. And that's why it's easy to get these guys to do that, because they want to overthrow Assad as well, for example.
Right.
The problem comes after the guy's overthrown or the war ends. These guys are also usually anti-American as well.
Right. Yeah.
And then they will turn their guns and their bombs against the U.S. Al-Qaeda perhaps being maybe the best example. They were certainly part of the Afghan insurgency against Soviet Union, and then they branched off and started to attack U.S. targets. So this is one of the real problems with that American policy. It shows short term, and they don't look at the blowback. Now, in the piece about John that we're discussing, I see also a legalistic distinction between terrorism and assassination.
Right.
John calls them terrorists. The 17 November is a terrorist organization, he claims, because they carried out assassinations. Where I believe, even though they are non-state actors, I don't believe that they're targeting random innocent civilians. I think they're targeting they're targeting civilians. It's not random. Now, these civilians may be innocent. They may be guilty. They may be guilty, but they're in a system where they have impunity, where they'll never come to trial or be arrested. So a group feels that their crimes are so egregious, they have to take extrajudicial measures because there are no judicial measures available. I'm not defending this. I'm trying to explain it.
Right.
And I do think, though, that there's a big distinction between random civilians dying and targeted civilians. So for me, this is political murder and assassination. And certainly when that there was an attempt against Hitler's life and he survived, there's one against Pinochet and he survived. And I think the target of the assassination has to be taken into account because, of course, Olof Palme, John F. Kennedy, Robert Kennedy, Martin Luther King, Malcolm X were all killed by assassins. And, well, depends on your political view. Because for some people on the right, those were all enemies. And they were maybe happy they died. People celebrated in the south of the U.S. when Kennedy was killed, JFK I'm talking about. So there were white supremacists and racists who celebrated, I'm sure, when Martin Luther King was killed. So it's all about the political view. I'm only making a legalistic issue, which I find interesting, but not vital to know. But there's a difference, in my view, between terrorism and assassinations. How do you feel about that, Don?
Yes. You know, there's so much to try to parse. And also, by the way, I mean, an awful lot of the things that you know, bear on this, they're unknowable. I mean, these are things that happen in a back room. If you look at the four corners of something, you can see that the people who control the Saudi state, the individuals who control it, who own it, in essence, fund a series of mosques that educate people in a particular religious philosophy that is tailor-made for deployment to solve CIA problems.
Mm-hmm.
People are trained in various countries then trained for military action after they've got the ideological training, and then deployed, and then organized, and then in places like Libya, even given the air cover from the U.S. Air Force, destroying state actors, you know, doing all kinds of things that have huge global repercussions. I mean, the refugee flow from the destruction of Libya is felt on seven continents. You know, all of these things, however, cannot be, or in any event, are not believed to be by most people the actions of a state. And so they're terrorist actions. But, you know, if there's a file somewhere that says, well, here's the memo from Barack Obama to the head of CIA to, you know, the head of the Al-Qaeda group that entered Libya in February of 2011 from Egypt, that says, okay, go get him. Well, now suddenly they are state actors, and so they are terrorists. And so, like I'm saying, there are many documents floating around, perhaps, or other evidence that could change everything we say that we're never going to see or we may never see and that may well be unknowable. Sure. So it's kind of angels on the head of a pin to say with certainty which this one is as opposed to that one. But, you know, we can look at what's happened, whose interests were benefited, how people behaved afterwards, you know, what we could have predicted, what did come to pass, and what fallout there was, and make, you know, certain conclusions and then use those to guess where things are going to go next with a reasonable amount of certainty, whether we know these other things or not.
Absolutely. The reason these are covert operations, because we're not supposed to know what happened, and it's very hard to find out, even decades later, exactly what happened. But the U.S. is certainly guilty of sponsoring terrorism. I mean, even in Vietnam. Sure. They were doing that as early as Vietnam, and before that, probably under Dulles, Alan Dulles in the 50s, so as CIA director. So that's the point I wanted to make. John's piece is well worth reading. It's extremely interesting. I think his critique of this prime minister, Alexis Tsipras, is right on. And the issue of terrorism, not as a side story, but I felt like doing that because I wanted an opportunity to talk about that.
This one really got me.
If you want to move on.
No, I want to, because a little bit I want to get to this too. We covered this in some depth at the time. I had a member of the European Parliament, who's a member of Syriza Party, that we spoke with a few times. A member of the Greek Parliament, who's a member of Syriza, that we spoke with a few times. Others, including a number of speeches that Varoufakis had made and some others, including also a few interviews with Richard Wolff, who knows Varoufakis and who had been speaking with him and other Syriza people at the time. So we covered it in some depth. And you know, what had happened was you started seeing this working class revolt against the EU in the countries where the wealth was being transferred from the working class and even the middle class to the wealthier countries inside the EU. In other words, from places like Greece, Ireland, Spain, Portugal, Italy, to Germany and France. And so you had seen first a right-wing response to that, which is kind of what you saw in Great Britain, at least initially, and then the left saying, some people on the left saying, you know, the Communist Party and Socialist Party have been with this program, the Euro-communists, Euro-socialists, etc. We're going to start standing for actual, you know, communist and socialist and working class politics and force this through from the left. And so they actually had, you know, provided a critique of the left that the voters bought.
Yeah.
And they were supposed to come in and clean it up, and it turned out what they did. I'm not going to impute intent to anyone. That's like a ridiculous, you know, it's a fool's errand. But, you know, you can conclude from looking at it that what happened was they traded in left politics in order to get elected instead of the left, and then they turned around and made an accommodation with Germany.
Right.
They sold to the Greek people after, as John Kiriakou recites through this thing, the Tsipras calls for the referendum, the Grexit referendum, and then the night that it happens, according to Varoufakis, says, expletive deleted, we won this. Almost like, now what? And so, you know, so he threw Greece to the wolves anyway, and then Varoufakis, as John relates. But what happened there was something that we saw happen then in other parts of Europe subsequently, where it looked like there was a left rising to actually deal with the whole austerity, you know, the 20-30 year project of, you know, impoverishing the working class and reversing the gains of the post-war period, that people were starting to stand up to deal with that. And those places where the party that advocated this were successful at the ballot box turned around and handed it off once they got in. So, you know, we haven't seen that kind of change happen, despite Syriza, Podemos, and others.
Tsipras better hope there's a shortage of yellow vests in Greece, because this could come back down to get him. I want to say one final thing about him. Again, you're absolutely right. We cannot understand the intentions of an individual. And this was just my feeling at the time. But even before this referendum took place and right after it, my feeling was he was really soaking in the limelight. Being a young, very young guy, wasn't expected to win. He really came out of nowhere, and all of a sudden he's standing next to Angela Merkel, and Hollande, the French president at the time,
charismatic working class
Cameron.
Hero. Yep.
And I felt he really, I could see it, although this is pure inference on my part, that he enjoyed being part of this crowd, this very rarefied air. Yeah. And I was frightened that he would be able to be easily manipulated by these much savvier and older and experienced politicians who got to those powerful positions in Europe because they understand the game, and he didn't. And I don't know if that played a role, but I felt he wants to be part of that circle, you know, and he really enjoyed that. That's just an impression. I never met the guy. I don't know him. But that's just my impression. That's part of it, I think. And I think that kind of vanity really does play a role in politics and journalism. But absolutely, that I know much better, because that's my field, where I know journalists are driven by vanity and fame and being part of the crowd, you know, and go along with it. I make a point here. The new National Press Club president in Washington here, I've just become a member, was elected, and they're having a big inauguration at the club, and it costs $115 for a member and a couple, a member and a guest. And you know who's signing in the new president?
Who?
Chief Justice David Souter.
No kidding.
So think about that. We're journalists. We're supposed to be criticizing these guys. We're supposed to be adversarial towards them. We're supposed to keep a distance from them. And they bring in a Chief Justice of the United States Supreme Court to inaugurate the president of the press club. I shouldn't be. I just joined them. Already I'm criticizing them publicly here.
No, but that's okay.
But I found that just very symbolic. And there are worse things than that. But that's
I think it's perfect, though.
Let's go on to another story.
No, I think you're absolutely right, though. I mean, not for nothing, you would expect that whoever it is that power finds most offensive at the moment. Maybe it would be a judge from Russia or something, would be who you would solicit to swear in. In other words, someone to show that the press is a watchdog yes. over these people, not a lapdog.
Yep. But, I don't think there should be any inauguration at all. Just take over the job too, and do right. the business. Yeah, it's not a really well-known position, even in right. Washington, right. who's the president of the National Press Club right. of the reporters. And she is a working reporter at the club. Who cares? I mean, you know, right. really. Right. I mean, I was a longtime member of the UN Correspondents Association in New York. Uh-huh. I was on executive committee many, many years. And we never had that kind of rubbish, although yeah. we did go up and meet the Secretary General once a year and have lunch with him. That was a perk, which I wouldn't all that. But at least you had a chance to ask him questions.
Right, that's right.
You know, it was kind of a press conference, informal, off the record.
Right.
So, but this is in front of a crowd, and it's really surprised me in a way, although it's an establishment organization of the establishment media, so maybe I shouldn't have been that surprised. If you want to go on another story, we could do that.
Yeah, we'll do that. So let's go to the sequel to the British betrayal of World War I, which takes a look at some real Middle East history that isn't discussed very often, which includes George H.W. Bush, the late,
absolutely.
Recently buried George H.W. Bush.
Right. The top headline is George H.W. Bush's Bitter Legacy in the Middle East, the sequel to the British Betrayal of World War I, is written by Asad Abu Khalil. We've talked about him before on your show, Don, the AKA Angry Arab.
Right.
His insightful analysis of the Middle East, who he knows more about the region than about 100 people I know combined who write about the Middle East. So I'm really happy he writes about the region. And he knows American politics too, because he's been in the U.S. for over 20 years as a professor out in California. So he has a very interesting take on Bush Sr., who died. And he's basically saying that, two things. He really loved the power and the wealth of the Gulf Arabs. He was very impressed by that. He liked sucking up to them. He quotes him in a book that's saying, Bush just says, I'd never seen so much and of nearly every conceivable type of food. So he was impressed by all that stuff. As wealthy as a man as he was, so he was in his class element there.
Right.
But it's really when it comes to Israel that Bush was a really interesting character. Now, under Reagan, I believe, and correct me if I'm wrong, and when he was Vice President Bush, Reagan, they cut off aid to Israel at one point because of the settlements.
Right.
And at that time, Menachem Begin, I believe the Prime Minister, said, we only kneel to God, not to the Americans. So they were really pissed off because the Americans were doing this. But when Bush came in, he did similar things. He first, of course, he was UN ambassador. Then he became vice president. Then he was president, and all through that, and through his early oil days in Texas, he started through the oil lobby in the U.S. To try to get connections with Saudi Arabia. So he traces back in this article, all the way to that. But Bush administration banned George Bush, H.W. banned Ariel Sharon from entering the U.S. government buildings.
Right.
Because of his statements against the U.S. role in the peace process. Can you tell me another, and I'm loath to praise this guy, George H.W. Bush, you tell me another administration, maybe Jimmy Carter would do something like that. He certainly, since being president, has been very vocal in support of the Palestinians. But aside from Carter, do you know any other president who would do such a thing?
No, and actually, he makes note of the fact that when Jack Kemp, who was the HUD secretary at the time, wanted to meet with Sharon, James Baker, the White House chief of staff, told him, meet him outside government buildings.
Yeah, I was serious about this.
Yep.
So he was cool to the Israelis when he had to be. And then, of course, he was dogged by Israeli lobby and Israeli supporters for years by a quote that he made, which was because of his more even-handed view, let's put it, towards Israel, or not, suck up right. view to Israel, like almost every president does.
Right.
He once said, I'm one lonely guy fighting the lobby on the Hill.
1,000 lobbyists, yeah.
1,000 lobbyists, 1,000 pointers of light and 1,000 lobbyists.
That's what he said.
So that is an extraordinary statement for anybody in American public life to make about Israel.
Yep.
But for the sitting U.S. president to make it, Well, tells you something, that he had a little bit of independence with Israel, and that might be the only silver lining in the 4 years of Bush's presidency and his entire career as CIA director. And we talked about that, I think, on the last show. We talked a little bit about Bush because he had just died. So, but this was just a look at his Middle East positions, and it was worth bringing this up again that he was branded an anti-Semite for deferring 120 days, $10 billion in loan guarantees to Israel. Imagine that.
I know.
That made him an anti-Semite because he just really.
But you know, on the other side of the coin, he started a war against Iraq. In 1990, that's still going on. He completely destroyed that rival to Israel in the region, and you now have, as he points out in the article, U.S. bases and military action: Iraq, Kuwait, Qatar, Libya, Saudi Arabia, Oman, the United Arab Republic, Syria, and a whole bunch of other places where they never had been before.
Absolutely. Absolutely. That first Gulf War was, while it didn't have the same destructiveness as his son's war, it was a horrendous war because there was an opportunity to solve that war. Saddam put out a peace deal to the Arab League. It was totally ignored. He was willing to withdraw under certain conditions. They never even explored that seriously. Although, I have to say, this was still back in the day where the U.S. at least made a pretense of diplomacy. So he sent Jim Baker, who then became his Secretary of State, if you recall, to meet with Tariq Aziz, the foreign minister of Iraq at the time. They had the cameras rolling on the table, and they spoke at least, but I think it was all for show because they had made up their mind. They were going to go to war, but Bush got what his son couldn't get, which was a UN authorization. It may have been a little easier because there was an invasion and occupation of another sovereign state by Iraq. So under the UN charter, that was technically certainly a violation. So Bush was able to put together a coalition of the willing. And another thing that was interesting is that he was able to get Israel, if you recall, not to respond when Saddam sent Scuds to Israel. And the Israelis were fuming. They wanted to respond, and Bush was able to stop them from doing that to not further inflame the war or engage Israel directly into the war. So that was another kind of an achievement in a backhanded way. But his war on, as you say, it's very good observation you made that this war is still going on. It's basically the same war because it was in the interim was all about weapons inspections and very onerous sanctions that killed up to 500,000 Iraqi children, for which Madeleine Albright told Leslie Stahl in 60 Minutes that it was worth it.
Yep. And we got about 3 minutes left, maybe 2.5 minutes. Let's take a quick look also at Anne Wright's piece about, it's titled U.S. Open Doors After Vietnam War and Could Do So Again, and in reference to Central America. To me, it's almost like, you had the Comprador class from Southeast Asia.
Yep.
That, you know, came running back to Papa, basically, to the United States after, the Day of Reckoning took place. You have almost the opposite dynamic in Honduras.
Right.
You had the actual democratically elected government taken out by a U.S.-backed coup, and the people that are fleeing the Nazis, that were placed in power by the Obama administration, coming here, and now they're seeing a wall put up in front of them and saying, maybe we can let them in.
Yeah, no, you're right. That's a good point. No question about that. I don't know if all the Vietnamese were people who had served the United States and were fleeing, but certainly that was, I think, the vast majority of them, and it is a very different crowd. But it's funny that while Anne wrote this piece before this article came out in the Atlantic saying that Trump wants to go back and kick out some of these Vietnamese from the 70s.
Yeah, I saw that.
Imagine that? So that was quite a coincidence that she had already written this piece.
Yeah.
And then Trump made this statement. So, I mean, the argument, and it's a really, really complex one, it has created a lot of division in our comment section on this. There's a lot of people who were really upset with her because they feel that these immigrants should not be allowed in because the U.S. working class is suffering as much as they do.
Right.
I understand that. But as you pointed out, the U.S. was responsible very much for what happened in Honduras, as an example. And just like in the Middle East, they were certainly responsible for Libya and Syria. They have had a huge role. And the ongoing economic exploitation of Africa, so that creates economic migrants. And then there are war refugees. And the West has a direct hand in both of them without question. So there is a responsibility. The responsibility begins with not doing those things, not right. exploiting the African continent, not backing a coup in Honduras, not bombing the hell out of Libya and overthrowing the government and creating this mess. So that's where it should start. Exactly. And that's where the argument has to begin. And it never does in the corporate media. It's only the result of these actions that we talk about and never the causes.
You know, the corporate media failed to report that, as a matter of fact, with the invasion of Libya, that Muammar Gaddafi was predicting exactly what's happened,
yes.
would happen, that did happen, and yep. now all of the fallout from there. All right, Joe, we got to finish here. Thank you very much, and we'll catch up with you next week.
Very good, Don. Thank you for having me again. Bye.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.